So turn again, please, in your Bibles to Revelation chapter 12, verse 17, to chapter 13, verse 18. Now back in chapter 11, verse 7, we were given a very brief glimpse of a new character in Revelation, a character I said at the time would emerge again later on. And sure enough, in this morning's passage, we encounter that character again. And this time, it's not a fleeting reference. This time, we have a whole section focused on this particular character. And I'm referring then, if you haven't already guessed it, to the beast. Now, commenting there on chapter 11, verse 7, I said that the background to this character lies the background to much of Revelation lies in the book of Daniel, and particularly then in Daniel chapter 7. There Daniel has a vision comprising four different beasts, and we're told quite plainly there in Daniel 7 that those four beasts, they represent four kingdoms, four specific earthly powers that would step onto the stage of world history. But the interesting thing about this beast in Revelation 13 is that you can't fully identify him with any one of those four beasts in Daniel 7. If you like, he's an amalgam of them all. There are features of all those four beasts in this beast here in Revelation 13, from which I think we can probably infer then, in keeping with Revelation's normal approach of painting in broad brushstrokes, dealing in patterns and trends rather than in specific historical details, I think we can probably infer that this beast here in Revelation, it represents earthly powers generally, in a generic sense, not one particular earthly power at one particular point in history, but earthly powers generally. That's the significance of this new character. And if then I'm right on that, if that is the case, then just at the most obvious level, before we probe any of the details of this passage, it seems to be saying, doesn't it, two things at least about earthly powers. Number one, they are Satan's agents. Notice then that he is presented as kind of, it seems, summoning this beast out of the sea. So in verse 17 of chapter 12, Satan goes and stands, he's the dragon of course, he goes and stands on the sand of the sea, and then in the first verse of chapter 13, this beast rises out of the sea. And it seems then that the dragon, that Satan is kind of summoning this beast, that in some way the beast, earthly powers, are the agent of Satan. And then the second obvious thing is that earthly powers then are beast-like. Because Revelation, of course, doesn't deal in meaningless pictures. Jesus is pictured as a lamb because he was sacrificed on the cross of Calvary. The church is pictured as a woman because she's in this intimate marital relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. The Satan is pictured as a dragon because he's aggressive, and so on. That the pictures we encounter in Revelation aren't random and meaningless, and presumably then it's with equally good reason that earthly powers here are pictured as a beast. So those two things seem to be immediately obvious. Now, straight away, I think we need to qualify that in an important way. And my qualification is this, that those two points don't express the whole truth about earthly powers. To get the whole truth about earthly powers, you have to go to other Bible passages as well. Not least, you have to go to a passage like Romans 13. Where, of course, earthly powers are presented in a very different light. There, they are not presented as Satan's agents, but as God's agents. And there, they're not presented as performing a kind of bestial, beast-like role, but rather as rewarding good and punishing evil. So, that qualification is very, very important. And I think then the point is this, that at certain times and in certain places in history, earthly powers can become, under Satan's influence, these beasts, or this beast that we are encountering here in Revelation 13. It's not that earthly powers are always beast-like and always acting in a very direct way in Satan's service. But at certain times and in certain places, that can happen. You notice, actually, in verse 5 of chapter 13, we have that that time reference again, 42 months, 3.5 years, if you like. And again, remember what we said about that, that that denotes an incomplete period. A complete period in Revelation's terms would be 7 years, 84 months. But this is 42 months, denoting a partial period, an incomplete period. And suggesting then, I think, that the beast isn't always operative. Earthly powers aren't always, in every place, beast-like and acting as Satan's agents. But at times, at certain times and in certain places, this does happen. And no doubt it was very relevant for John's readers, who were there living in within that Roman Empire, which I think we can probably infer was increasingly beast-like in the way that is being pictured here. And of course, we can easily think of other regimes, other kingdoms, other states, other earthly powers throughout history and in our own world today, where there is this satanic agency going on and where those earthly powers are positively beast-like. So that's important to establish all of that. But having done so, let's probe our passage further and let's ask then how, in those times, at those times and in those places, how are earthly powers, these earthly powers that we're talking about, under the influence of Satan, how are they like a beast? And I think we can suggest three ways from our passage. First of all, then, they are impressive. They are impressive. So look at verse 2, then, the description of the beast there. And we read then that he was like a leopard, but then at the same time his feet were like a bear's and his mouth was like a lion's mouth. Now, why is it then that even though Peck's Corner at Jesmond Dean is free of charge, why is it that you go along there and it's usually fairly quiet and all fairly low-key, whereas you go to Edinburgh Zoo and you have to pay a small fortune to get in, and yet the place is heaving and there are busloads of people queuing up there? Why is that? Well, with all due respect to the geese and the rabbits and the whatever else at Jesmond Dean, they're just not quite as impressive, are they, as the leopards and the bears and the lions that we go to see at Edinburgh Zoo. There's something impressive about these creatures. We want to see them. And that then is what we are being told here about this beast. It's impressive. This beast is impressive. It's leopard-like, lion-like, bear-like. And thus then, you go to verse 8 and you see that the beast is being worshipped. All who dwell on earth will worship it. And this isn't a coerced kind of worship. This isn't that these people have been forced into worshipping. Because you see in verse 3, for instance, the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. They're in wonder at the beast. And then verse 4, they're shouting out, who is like the beast? So this is genuine, spontaneous worship being given to the beast because it is so impressive. I think that's saying then that at those times in history when Satan uses this particular mode of operation that we're talking about this morning, when he works through an earthly power in a very direct way, often this feature will be observable. that earthly power will be beast-like in its sheer impressiveness. It will be impressive. Especially, perhaps, impressive in its military might. I think you get that sense here. So, verse 4, it's who is like the beast and who can fight against it? The beast is so strong, so militarily powerful. Or verse 3, that interesting verse, one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed and the whole earth marveled. And perhaps the point there is then this, these earthly powers that perhaps seem to be down and out, they seem to have been beaten, but then they kind of clutch, they gain victory out of the jaws of defeat, and they come back from seemingly being crushed. And again, it's perhaps a hint of military prowess, military might. But doubtless we could include other things in this impressiveness as well, not just military might perhaps, but just the bureaucratic structures, the political structures of these earthly powers. Their grand architectural and industrial projects and so on. There's something impressive about these earthly powers that are being represented here by the beast. So that people worship these earthly powers. And that, of course, was happening in John's day. People would worship Caesar. People would worship the Roman emperor. And again, not necessarily because it was forced, because it was compulsory, although in certain parts of the empire it no doubt was, but just because Caesar was so impressive. His armies, his projects, his whole empire, it was amazing, it was massive, it was stunning. And so people worshipped Caesar. And of course, what was happening in John's day happens still, doesn't it? Today, you think of an obvious place like North Korea, where, again, the state makes itself impressive through its military might and its architecture and just the grandeur of its governmental structures, so that its people will worship the ruling Kim. There's a fascinating review that George Orwell wrote in 1940 of Hitler's book Mein Kampf. And it's not so much a review, actually. It's more Orwell trying to analyse the appeal of Hitler and how it was that he gained such a following. And this is what Orwell writes. He says, "Nearly all Western thought since the last war, certainly all progressive thought, has assumed tacitly that human beings desire nothing beyond ease, security, and avoidance of pain. In such a view of life, there is no room, for instance, for patriotism and the military virtues. Hitler, however, knows that human beings don't only want comfort, safety, short working hours, hygiene, birth control, and in general common sense. They also, at least intermittently, want struggle and self-sacrifice, not to mention drums, flags, and loyalty parades. Whereas socialism and even capitalism in a more grudging way have said to people, 'I offer you a good time,' Hitler has said to them, 'I offer you struggle, danger, and death.' And as a result, a whole nation flings itself at his feet." And really, I suppose what we're encountering then here in chapter 13 is the same phenomenon as chapter 9. You remember in chapter 9, we saw that one of God's judgments, actually, one of those trumpets, one of God's judgments against unbelievers now in this present age, is allowing Satan and his demons to deceive unbelievers into idol worship. That's going on all the time, Revelation 9 is saying. That Satan is deceiving unbelievers into worshipping idols. And we've got exactly the same thing going on here then, in chapter 13. But here it's a very specific idol. It's the idol of the state. It's the idol of earthly powers. And here then, it's Satan deceiving men and women at certain points in history, in certain places, into worshipping rulers and powers and states and governments. It's idol worship. And if you just then glance at the second half of the chapter, where I think from verse 11 onwards, we essentially have the same theme. Again, we have here the beast being worshipped, don't we? There in verse 12, we have the earth's inhabitants worshipping the first beast. And indeed, we have now images being made of the beast in verse 14. And of course, that is often a feature, isn't it, where earthly powers are worshipped, whether it was in the Roman Empire, whether it's in North Korea today, that images of the ruler are made. There are pictures everywhere of the ruler who is supposed to be worshipped. But there's a development here in this second half of the chapter, and the development is this, that we have another character involved, don't we? Another character who, it seems, facilitates the worship of the beast. And of course, this other character is also called a beast. There in verse 11, he's referred to as another beast. And I think the point of that is just simply to show his close connection to the main beast. And I don't think beyond that we should really stress, we should really highlight, emphasize the fact that this second character is a beast. He's never called that again, not throughout this chapter, not throughout the rest of Revelation. He's given a different title, actually, throughout the rest of the book, on three occasions. In chapter 16, verse 13, chapter 19, verse 20, and chapter 20, verse 10, he's referred to not as another beast, but as the false prophet. The false prophets. And even though he's not given that title here in our passage, we do see him performing that kind of role. So notice, for instance, this partial resemblance he has to a lamb in verse 11. He had two horns like a lamb. Probably an allusion to Jesus' words in Matthew 7 verse 15, warning about wolves in sheep's clothing. And here we have this character in lamb's clothing, at least, or with certain aspects, a certain resemblance of a lamb. And what was Jesus talking about in Matthew 7:15? Well, he was talking about false prophets. He uses that phrase. And here then, this character in the second half of Revelation 13 is being presented as a false prophet. Or then again, look at verse 14 and the way that he performs these signs. Impressive, presumably deceiving signs. Verse 13, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. Now, we've already had those kind of signs, haven't we? Back in chapter 11. In chapter 11, verses 5 and 6, we had those kind of signs mentioned, including fire. And there, it was, you remember, the church exercising its kind of prophetic, declarative ministry. And so that was what the church did in chapter 11. And here now we have this character kind of doing the same thing, but doing it in a deceiving way. So it's, again, a characteristic of false prophecy. So this second character, I'm saying, yes, he's described as another beast, but it's probably more helpful to think of him in terms of his later title in the book, the false prophet. And I think the situation then is this, that here in the second half of the chapter, we're again being presented with essentially the same situation, unbelievers being deceived into worshipping the idol of earthly powers. But here we have now a specific category of unbelievers. Those unbelievers who are actually within the professing church. Unbelievers who are within, I suppose, what theologians have often called over the years the visible church. Who seem to be Christians, who seem to be believers. And of course, these people, because of their Christian connections, they are not so readily just going to kind of transgress the first commandment and start worshipping Caesar or worshipping some emperor, some earthly ruler. But they perhaps will do it if someone in their church who wears a smart suit and who has a degree from the best Bible seminary and who has a very pious bearing about him, if he comes along and says, look guys, it's fine, you can do this, you can go along and to some civic event and worship the emperor and still be a good Christian, you can do both. You can still essentially worship Jesus Christ, but worship the earthly power as well. If someone in their church were to preach that message, then they might well be much more amenable to doing it. And of course, we've seen that very thing happening. Go, remember the letters to the churches in the first, in chapters 2 and 3, in Pergamum and Thyatira especially. People were doing that. Those who hold to the teaching of Balaam in Pergamum, that woman Jezebel in Thyatira, and they were saying to those Christians in those churches, look, you can do this. You can worship idols. You can worship the emperor and still be a good Christian and member of this church. And they then, those infiltrators, they are this second beast, the false prophets. The false prophet here stands for those who actually get Christian, or professing Christians rather, to join in the worship of the earthly power. So that's the first thing then, and I wanted to spend longest on that, how are earthly powers then, at these particular points in history, how are they beast-like? Well, first of all, in that they are impressive, and by being impressive, they evoke worship. Worship from unbelievers outside the church and also unbelievers inside the visible church. But secondly, how are earthly powers beast-like? They are brutal. They are brutal. So we do like to go to Edinburgh Zoo and we do like to look at the leopards and the lions and the bears, but as we are fascinated by them and their impressiveness, at the same time we're rather glad that there's a wall or a fence or some kind of barrier between us and them, because we know if they could once get hold of us, they would be pretty brutal in their treatment of us. And so you have that emphasis here with regard to this beast. Not only is this beast in Revelation 13 impressive, he's also brutal. And of course, his brutality is very targeted. It's targeted against Christians. Verse 7 of chapter 13, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. So this then is talking about these earthly powers. As I say, not always, at every time and every place, but at certain times, in certain places, earthly powers being brutal in their treatment of Christians. And that brutality then is spelt out in several ways in our passage. So we have that general reference to making war on the saints in verse 7, but then you go down to verse 10, and a reference there to Christians being taken captive, imprisoned. Then the second half of verse 10, or rather the middle part of verse 10, Christians being slain with the sword, executed by earthly powers. Or then that interesting reference further down the passage in verses 16 and 17 to more of a kind of discriminatory treatment against Christians by earthly powers in ordinary everyday life. So the earthly powers denying Christians the right to buy or sell, to engage in commerce and trade, to earn a living essentially. And remember, we've seen this. We saw it in chapter 6. And remember how the third seal in chapter 6 was that ride on a black horse with a pair of scales in his hands. And we said that represented famine, but famine particularly that Satan was targeting against Christians. And remember, we've been told back in chapter 2, verse 9, of the church in Smyrna, which was probably the most faithful church of all the ones I mentioned. There's nothing bad at all said about the church in Smyrna. But we are told of its poverty, that the people in that church, probably precisely because they were faithful Christians, were poor. because they were being discriminated against, probably, by the powers and authorities. And it's interesting, by the way, in this connection, just to notice verse 6. Verse 6 is fascinating, where we have then the beast opening its mouth to utter blasphemies against God. Well, we can understand that. And blaspheming his name, yes, but then also blaspheming his dwelling. And what is God's dwelling? Well, God's dwelling, of course, is heaven. You think, well, how then does the beast, how do the earthly powers blaspheme heaven? How do they target heaven? Well, it goes on to say, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Which doesn't seem to make it any clearer. Well, how do the earthly powers target those who dwell in heaven? Surely that's those people are beyond their reach. But I think the point is this. It's talking actually about Christians who are on earth, but who, in one sense, already dwell in heaven. Because that's what the New Testament teaches about Christians, isn't it? That yes, in one very important sense, we dwell here on earth. In another very important sense, we already reign with Christ in the heavenly realms, Ephesians 2. And probably then, that verse is giving us a little hint as to why these earthly powers hate Christians so much. Because they recognize that these Christians have a higher allegiance. That as Paul puts it in Philippians 3, their citizenship is in heaven. They have another citizenship. And these earthly powers don't fully control these Christians. Yes, they're good citizens, and they pay their taxes, and they live uprightly, but they nonetheless belong ultimately to a different kingdom, and that infuriates these despotic and controlling earthly leaders like Caesar. And that's why these earthly rulers of that ilk are so passionately hostile toward Christians. And so it's, again, a familiar theme in Revelation, this brutality of earthly powers at certain points, at certain times, toward Christian people. And of course, as we've said so often, that's a very solemn theme. And it's a theme we should never treat lightly. And we read there at the end of verse 10 that it calls for endurance and faith on the part of those saints who are caught up in it. And many Christians are, of course, in our world today. And we should be praying, shouldn't we, continually for the endurance and the faith of those saints who are being persecuted today by brutal earthly regimes. But, having said all that, as we have seen so often in Revelation, there is another emphasis here. Namely, that what these earthly powers can do to these Christians is actually, in the last analysis, limited. They can only persecute. And as I say, that it's easy for us to say that, because we're not facing persecution. But nonetheless, that is the limit of what they can do. And of course, remember the whole context here. Remember that in chapter 12, verses 13 to 16... we have the dragon, Satan, having been defeated by Christ, trying to get at Christ's people and trying to deceive them into idol worship, trying to deceive Christ's people. But remember, he couldn't do that. He couldn't deceive them. He tries to flood them with this flood from his mouth, picturing deception, lies, false ideas. But remember how God just kind of carries them away from that flood on wings like eagles. We said it was perhaps a picture of the Holy Spirit last week. And Satan cannot do what he'd really like to do and deceive these believers. And it's precisely because he can't do that, which he'd really like to do, that then in verse 17 instead he has to resort to calling up this beast and simply brutalizing God's people instead. Persecuting them physically, making war on them, imprisoning them, slaying them with the sword. Because he can't do what he'd really like to do. He can't deceive them. They're undeceivable. because God is protecting them, or because, as it's put here in our passage now in verse 8, because their names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. They can't be deceived. They can be persecuted. Christians can be battered and battered and battered in the form of external persecution by earthly powers. But there's not an earthly power in the world, and there never has been, that can actually deceive Christ's true people and turn them into idol worshippers. Because Christ's true people have been chosen from before the world began to be Christ's true people. It's such a shame, isn't it, that doctrine is turned into something controversial and sensitive and difficult and complex, when everywhere in the New Testament it's presented as the most wonderfully pastorally comforting doctrine. We have been chosen from before the foundation of the earth. That's how committed to us God is. That's how determined God is, that he won't lose one single one of us. He wrote our names in a book. He hasn't just recently thought of possibly saving us. This isn't a knee-jerk reaction to something. This is a decision he made before there was a universe in existence. He's determined to keep his people. And so persecution can be really, really intense. But that is the devil's only weapon at the end of the day. The earthly power's only weapon against those people whose names are written in the book. So how are these earthly powers beast-like? They're impressive, they are brutal. But then thirdly and finally, they are fake. They are fake. So I've been saying then that this beast pictured for us, described for us in verse 2, is impressive. It is, but having said that, it would perhaps be a bit more impressive were it not for something else we've already encountered in Revelation, back in chapter 5, verse 5. There, you remember, we encountered a lion. A lion. The lion of the tribe of Judah. And we had him roaring in chapter 10, verse 3 also. Jesus, of course. And actually, alongside the lion, the beast doesn't look all that impressive. And I think we're supposed to see here that the beast is kind of trying to be the lion, but failing. And yes, he's got a mouth that's a bit like a lion's, but that's as far as he can get. And yes, he can be pretty beast-like and pretty big and pretty impressive. But he's not a lion. And however much evolution he tries to go through, he can't evolve himself into a lion. And I think then that it's saying to us this about these earthly powers at certain points in history, that they try to compete with Christ himself. You see, the New Testament presents this kind of arrangement, doesn't it? That you have, in terms of rule, you have the rule of God the Father. But then, of course, God the Father has appointed his king. We'll sing in a moment from Psalm 2. I have appointed on Zion my king. That's the Messiah, that's Jesus, who is, of course, the one who holds the scroll. He's the ruler of the cosmos by God's appointment. So there's the Father's rule. Then he has appointed Christ as the ruler of the universe. And then, of course, beneath Christ, there are these earthly powers who are also appointed by God. We said that from Romans 13. They are God's appointed rulers as well, but in a much more local and in a much more subordinate sense. But you see, what happens at certain points in history is that that bottom rung, those earthly rulers, they try to step up a level and try to compete with the next king, the Lord Jesus. And so you have throughout this passage that idea, I think. You have this kind of idea of imitation going on, mimicry. The earthly powers trying to be like the true power, Jesus. So look at verse 3 again, and you know that idea of one of his heads having the mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And it doesn't come across quite so clearly here in our version, but the language is almost identical to, again, Revelation 5:6, the lamb as slain. And here, the beast as slain, but still living on. And it's almost as if it's trying to imitate the resurrected one. Or there, the language at the end of verse 3, the earth marveled as they followed the beast. You just jump over into chapter 14 and verse 4, and we will have the phrase, people following the lamb. Again, trying to imitate Christ, the true ruler. Or just the fact then that this beast kind of commissions this false prophet that we've talked about in the second half of the chapter to prophesy for him. In the same way as Christ has kind of commissioned his prophets in chapter 11 to prophesy for him on his behalf. Or then the fact that the beast puts a mark of ownership on its followers, which of course Christ does. We've read about the seal, haven't we, in Revelation? Christ puts a mark of ownership on his followers. And so there are all these different ways in which the beast is kind of trying to copy Christ. And as I say, I think it's pointing to this point, that earthly powers, these ones we're talking about, certain points in history, they are trying to kind of step off the bottom rung and rival Christ, the true ruler, who is, of course, to be worshipped. And that, I think, is the significance of the final verse of our passage, which has often perplexed and given rise to lots of different interpretations. But this calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. So it's talking here about the mark that the beast puts on his followers. This is all, of course, pictorial. It's just that the fact that these earthly powers, they want to possess their subjects, their people. There's no literal mark. But the mark then is pictured as a number, and it's a number of a man, or better, you could translate that, it's a human number, a human number. And I think pointing then to the fact that in John's day, Caesar made himself out to be a divine king. And this verse is saying, no, actually, he's just a human ruler with a human number. He's a fake. He might make images of himself, and he might get people to follow him, and he might call forth worship, but he's a fake. He's not a true divine king as he says he is. His mark is a human mark. Everything about him at the end of the day is human. He's a person. He's just a human being, like everybody else. And then his number is 666. Well, we've seen, haven't we, so often, that the number of kind of perfection, of completeness in Revelation is 7. And you could perhaps almost say then that Christ's number, the number of the true king, is 777, 3 sevens. But these earthly powers, they're not true divine kings like they make out to be. They're fake. 666, 3 sixes, a kind of trinity of imperfection, of incompleteness. It's like when you go shopping to some market and you see some item that has a brand name and it's very cheap, and so you think, wow, that's amazing, and so you buy it and you take it away, and then you notice that actually the logo on it of the brand, it's kind of just one letter that's different, it's slightly misspelled, and you realize it's a fake. And that's the significance of 666. It's these earthly rulers making out they are the grand king to be worshipped, but actually they're fake. It's not 777, it's 666. They're inauthentic. And of course, that fakeness always manifests itself in the end, doesn't it? That story is probably apocryphal. You'll have heard it before, but I quite like it anyway, of the Roman Emperor Julian in the 4th century. and his soldiers had captured a Christian, were making sport of him, hitting him, beating him, all the rest of it. And at one point, as they were doing this, they said to this Christian who's lying on the ground there, "So where's your carpenter now?" Jesus, they were meaning, "Where's your carpenter now?" To which apparently the Christian responded, "He's on the throne and he's building the coffin for your emperor." And so the story goes, it was in that battle that Julian was killed. But you see the point. At the end of the day, the fakeness always manifests itself in the end. Where is the Roman Empire today? Where is every persecuting earthly power from history today? The North Korean regime will go the same route as the Roman Empire. Because as we will discover in chapter 19, there's only one King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And that's Jesus Christ. He's the real thing. 777, not 666. And this morning we worship him as our King. Amen.